This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Live from Seahawks training camp, powered through the Alaska Airlines studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our Seahawks training camp coverage is presented by Precor Home Fitness as we continue live from the VMAC, and it's a pleasure to bring this guy to the program. He's a man who knows all. You see him on NHL Network, MLB Network. He is just one of the true nice guys in all the sports. He's with us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Our buddy John Morosi is with us. How are you, man?
Bob and Dave, I am outstanding. A fun couple weeks there with the expansion draft, NHL entry draft, MLB trade deadline, NFL training camp starting up. No shortage of stuff to talk about, gentlemen.
No, there's a lot, and I've got a cracking question for you. I'll save for the end, but
sure.
You brought up trade deadline, and let's talk about, you know, before we talk about what happened around the league with the Mariners, and they made a trade, which I think most times you'd look at maybe from afar and go, that's fairly innocuous. It's a reliever. You know, Kendall Graveman gets shipped off. And it was really poorly received in that clubhouse. I mean, fans are one thing. Broadcasters are one thing, John. But the clubhouse made it known. There were stories written about guys talking about being betrayed, feeling betrayed. And they were mad that Jerry didn't even come down from his office to tell him. And that, you know, some guys were throwing things around. And, you know, Marco Gonzalez was, eyes were red from crying. And, you know, and this is on the heels of maybe one of the most improbable regular season wins they had had against the Astros. And they took 3 of 4 before that from the A's, and everything was, you know, looking like a playoff run here. And then that happens. Were you surprised, A, by the move, or and B, by the reaction to that move?
Yes and yes. I was surprised by both. The trade itself was surprising because, as you point out, the Mariners have been one of the best teams in the American League the last couple months. They've been that good. And so to change a piece that's so important to the late part of your bullpen was a surprise in that respect. The reaction also surprised me. And to which I say it's okay for us to be surprised by the reaction. Probably less okay for the front office to be surprised by the reaction, yeah, because it's their responsibility to have the pulse of the room. Now, I understand that it's different in COVID-19 times. I fully understand that you don't have that same level of personal interaction because of the various protocols that exist. I fully respect that, understand that. But there are conversations that you could have with your leadership group in the clubhouse, the coaching staff, manager, about, hey, if we trade this player, what would the reaction be? And it sounds as though if there had been a lot of background work done in that respect, with those conversations, it would have been a unanimous answer back, do not trade Kendall Graveman. And, of course, the Mariners are now 3-5 since then. We can't necessarily say that's the reason, but it is certainly, it appears to be a bit of a momentum stopper for a team that has had such success this year in winning the close games. They have a great record despite being outscored. And listen, I understand, in defense of Jerry Dipoto, I get it. You're trading a player whose contract is going to expire. You're bringing in someone in Diego Castillo in a different move that has more control, and Diego was closing for a World Series team last year. I understand that. I understand that transaction. But as you both know, there is a heartbeat to the game and a pulse to the game, and it sure seems like that was knocked off rhythm by what happened with that trade, and it's going to be interesting to see how the team performs the last couple months, because they had great momentum. That momentum has idled now, and let's see how they respond with a 4-game series at Yankee Stadium that I think is going to tell us a lot about where this team really stands.
Well, and John Paul, I would think that Dipoto is thinking, thank you, Abraham Toro, because he's become, you know, and this is just going into today, I think he had a hit today, but I mean, in his games as a Mariner, only 6 games, but he's batting .429, he's got 9 hits, 3 triples, 2 home runs. I mean, and what do you credit that to? Maybe it's just because the Astros are so deep. Bob was mentioning, yeah, he probably couldn't get on the field because, you know, he's got Altuve in front of him, but I don't know. It's funny how, and I don't know if this is going to continue, but he sure looks a lot better than was advertised coming from the Astros.
Well, he's a good player, and this is where I think that we have to acknowledge the wisdom in the move, that maybe it was a long-term gain on Toro, and if he's a central figure in this team making the playoffs in 2022, we have to give Jerry his due credit at that point in time and say, hey, there was some wisdom in that move. He's always been, to your point, a very athletic player, switch hitter. He can move around the diamond. And to what Jerry and others had said with the organization, he was someone who had been on the list of a lot of different teams to acquire as a guy who was getting ready to pop and really hop up on those screens of being a legitimate player. So I think that he is a good acquisition, again, in that vacuum of value and bringing in value. And clearly he can play. And I think he also has benefited, guys, from the experience of being in Houston. You know, he has seen a lot. That was a team that obviously has had superstars. It's been in the World Series in the last few years. The sign-stealing scandal hits. You can have a whole lifetime in baseball over the last 4 to 5 years of the Houston Astros. And Toro was there for that. He can explain and at a very young age what that was like to live and go through. He's also an incredibly smart player, speaks three languages. Of course, he grew up in Montreal, of Venezuelan heritage. So actually, given his Montreal roots, he also would probably have some very strong Kraken takes when you need it. So certainly, if you need to pivot to the Canadiens or the NHL, I'm sure Toro's going to have some good thoughts on that as well. But tremendous guy from everything I've heard, just a first-class person. And again, someone for whom he gets to Seattle. And I want to give him credit because he obviously was aware of the reaction to the trade. And it says something about a person to walk into the room when all that aftermath is there and you just play and perform. I think that is the mark of a really, really impressive young man, and Toro is that.
I think that's a great point. We were talking about, you know, that going through the trade, having to adjust to everything, and then, you know, like you said, kind of, you know, I'm sure he probably read the room better than DePoto did. Yeah. You know, knowing,
well,
you know,
well, DePoto wasn't in the room to read it, apparently.
Well, yeah,
that's what the story was saying.
Yeah. But I don't know, I think Jerry's been vindicated so far.
Hey, John, were you surprised by anything that the Mariners didn't do? That was sort of what we were trying to figure out. Like, all right, are they going to be in the mix, really, you know, when it comes to making a push for the postseason this year? This is going to tell us how much they truly believe in this group of players, and are they going to go out and get the pieces they need to get them over the hump? And Toro's been a nice story for a few games. Castillo blew a game, saved a game. Okay. That's kind of it, though. I mean, it's there wasn't a lot of activity. You know, Jerry said, hey, we tried. You know, we were in on things, and the asking prices got out of hand, what have you. So you can either credit him for restraint, or you can look at it and say, well, what's going on? How come do you not believe in this group? Should you have been more aggressive? Where are you at with that?
Well, a couple things. I think, number one, it's hard to go all in on rentals and justify it from an analytics standpoint when you're underwater with respect to run differential this deep into the season. Usually, if you're this far negative in your run differential, and fans may hate hearing about that, but the reality is that's how a lot of decisions are made. Okay, where are we at with the run differential? What does that say about how good of a team we really have, and how much should we invest? And also, how good do we expect to be in 2022? And I think Jerry made the calculation that this was not a go-for-broke year to trade, let's say, for example, Emerson Hancock to Colorado to get Trevor Story or John Gray, that this was not the year to do that. And in fact, the name that I think made the most sense for the Mariners, and I'm not going to say that it was Scherzer because I don't think it was, it would have been Jose Berrios with Minnesota. And of course, he ends up going to Toronto. I was told after the deadline had passed that the Mariners and Minnesota had some pretty substantive talks, and that ultimately, as the word came to me, the Jays just were comfortable going further than what Seattle was. And essentially, what it probably would have cost the Mariners, because it ended up costing the Jays basically two of their top five prospects, two of their top six, depending how you look at it, in Austin Martin and Simeon Woods Richardson. It probably would have taken either Emerson Hancock or George Kirby, plus another high-end player, maybe like a Noelvi Marte, who I've always loved as a shortstop. It'd be two top 100 prospects, basically, to get Berrios. And the Jays were willing to give approximately that, and the Mariners weren't. And it was that simple. And we can argue if that would have been the right move. I really think, and again, it's a lot to sit here and say. That's why it's a tough job that Jerry has. It's tough to say, yeah, trade Marte and trade Hancock, because they both have a chance to be a big part of the future. But then again, Berrios is also under control for next year. And either you get Berrios now, or you have to get to the free agent market and probably add someone like him this winter to really take that next step and be able to compete with Houston, to be able to compete with Oakland consistently. So I think that that's exactly what happened. I think ultimately would I have given up Kirby plus Marte for Berríos? I think I probably would have, but I'm not an executive. That's just my own statement on that. And I think the Jays were clearly willing to go to that point. And I think a part of that from the Jays' perspective is they believe they've got a chance to sign Jose long-term, and I'm not sure how the Mariners felt about that part of the equation.
John Paul, what do you think about the health of baseball this year? Bob sent an article last night about Trout and just entirely forgot about him, you know, Shohei Ohtani's there. But as far as, you know, financially and after last year with COVID and everything and the popularity that you're seeing around the league, what do you think the health is?
Well, Dave, it's an important question, and I'm glad you asked it because I think there's a lot of different ways to go with it. Number one, could the game be in a better place? Yes, I certainly think if the stars like Trout obviously were healthy and if the Angels were in the race, maybe that would be a little bit different. But I also take a step back and say you cannot, outside of Tatis's recent injury, you could not ask for more from a group of stars than what Tatis and Vlad Jr. and Ohtani have given the game. Ohtani has basically blew past any of these Babe Ruth comparisons. He is in a category unto himself. We are seeing something that's never happened in the history of baseball happen with Ohtani. And my reaction to that is, could baseball be marketing them differently? I don't really think so. I think that if you want to be entranced by Ohtani, you're watching him and you're aware of what he's doing. If you are a casual sports fan who is not predisposed to like baseball, you're probably not. And that's okay. Everybody has their own flavor of sport that they like. I think the American sports menu is fundamentally different than it was 35 years ago. It's just different. It's a different time. We have different channels. We have different things you can watch, whether it's on-demand programming, et cetera. So I'm not so sure that I would look at the ratings as much or how that looks. It's more, are fans in individual markets connecting with their teams? And I really think, I would say this, guys, I'm going to watch carefully attendance numbers this month, next month. I'm concerned about where Oakland's numbers are. Obviously, we understand the franchise could leave town. That's obviously part of it. But that's why I look at it more on the individual franchise level. Do the fans in Cleveland still feel invested? Do the fans in Seattle feel invested? And it seems like, for me, just what I hear in social media and obviously experiencing and watching the games, they seem enthused. Obviously, the trade deadline may have been a bit of a downer, but they seem to be interested in their team. And I think as long as you have a majority of markets, or maybe 60-70% of them, really excited about their particular team, because baseball, we have to acknowledge it, guys, it is a local regional sport, more so than a national sport. It just is. And I think that as long as you have that strong local connection in 70% or so of the teams at any given time, then you feel pretty good. And I really think right now, despite some pretty significant headwinds, I think the game is pretty close to that.
Hey, you know, you're talking about the young players, Tatis and Guerrero and players like that, which are phenomenal for the game. Do you think Jared Kelnick will be that guy next year? I don't think this year is not going to be it, certainly.
Right.
I mean, he's hitting 128. I was asking Dave, boy, do you think he can get close to 200 by the end of the season? I don't know if that's realistic that he's going to, you know, boost his average by 70 points by the end of the season. How do you view what he's done so far versus the expectations and the pomp and circumstance that surrounded him?
Well, it's a great question, Bob. And for me, I would look at it and say this. Kelnick and how he looks, how he performs next year, that's going to tell the tale for this franchise in a lot of ways. Because we even saw the game today. That's a learning moment. That's obviously a catchable ball in center field that was lost in all that is the Trop. And I'm not going to blame him for it. I'm just using that as an illustrative point to say moments like that happen. And when you're as young as he is, and you are putting the pressure on yourself that he has always put on himself, it really does take some time to learn and adjust. It does. And we have seen great players, even Trout. Trout's first introduction to the major leagues was not especially good. Obviously, he came back in the next year and was almost the MVP. I don't know if that's safe to expect from Jared, but he's really going to have to regroup here, because he is someone that really had never struggled before. And not only had he never really struggled at this level, at least, But confidence and his bravado is such a part of his identity. He is Harper-like in that respect. And a lot of his story I love. Of course, as a fellow Midwesterner, I love how he really is a self-made player. He goes to the USA team trials when he's underage. So basically, it was like the U18 trials, and he was one of the youngest kids at the camp. He was basically 16. He makes the team coming out of Waukesha, Wisconsin, which no one does coming out of Waukesha, Wisconsin. He willed his way onto that team because of what a competitor he is. And so that's part of his DNA. He's going to have to find a way, I think, to harness that and channel it. And you just need repetitions. Let the struggles happen. And we all know how humbling sports can be. Just let that happen. Live and get through it every single day and get a little bit better every day. Learn a little bit more. And then show up to Peoria next year as a better, more comprehensive player. And I think he will because this matters to him a lot. My only fear is that I just hope he doesn't put too much pressure on himself because his athleticism and ability is plenty good enough. We've seen that when it just lets it take over. And I think there was so much around when he was going to get promoted and the way spring training went. There was all that noise. And I just think that it's going to be a nice time for him in the winter to just go back to Wisconsin, mellow out a little bit, get some swings, and come back and really have a great 2022. And I believe he's going to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, just by way of comparison, and just I think he's a victim of the hype and everything, and you talked about his confidence. But Taylor Trammell, a guy who we loved his personality, just couldn't be more engaging, you know, really struggled at this level. But you look at him, at this point, Trammell's got 7 more at-bats at this level. So they're virtually identical in terms of the number of at-bats they've had at the pro level. And we were talking about how much he was floundering. He was hitting 160. Kelnick's hitting 128. He had 8 home runs. Kelnick's got 4. You know, he struck out more, but just in terms of production, a 256 on base, 217 for Kelnick. I mean, if you're just comparing two guys side by side, one we looked at is a very, you know, really disappointing, and you got to send this guy back to the minors. It's just he's so overwhelmed and overmatched here. And you look at them comparatively, he's beating Kelnick across the board.
It's interesting. And I guess one point I would make on both players, but I think especially for Jared, and I'm glad you framed it that way, because what you would have said, the advice 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, would have been, hey, you're having a hard time making contact right now. Let's shorten up a bit. Let's not take our A swing, as they like to call it. Let's not take our A swing all the time. Let's find our B swing, our B minus swing, and just put the ball in play, make some contact. But that mentality is gone from the game at the youth and early minor league levels in many places, not everywhere, but a lot of places. And so when you don't have another gear to downshift to just sort of, as Todd Jones, the eminently quotable Tigers closer, used to say, fake it till you make it. He would always say that when he was struggling on the mound. If you don't have that gear to move down to sort of fake it till you make it and just put the ball in play, get a couple singles, get your confidence back, if that gear does not exist on your car and you're going 100 miles an hour down I-5, you're in trouble. And that's I think, where a lot of the young players of the game, when they struggle, they have not learned the downshift. It doesn't exist in their game because they've been taught by swing gurus, hey, here's your loft angle, your launch angle swing. Here's your A swing. Do your A swing all the time. You'll get your numbers. If you hit 210, who cares? As long as you get your 30 home runs, you'll get paid. And that works for some guys to a certain point, but then the major league pitching equation comes in, and all these guys who are really good, who make a lot of money on the mound, go to school on your swing. And if you have an A swing that is your A swing, trust me, they can aim around that A swing and hit all the quadrants where that A swing isn't, and you get numbers like what you're seeing with Jared right now. And there's no, and they just have not learned how to do the alternate approach. And I think that's where we're seeing Jared and other players struggle now in baseball.
Let me ask you a cracking question before we let you go here. And I've sent these guys maybe 2 or 3 articles all like this. And the headline on this one reads, early on, Seattle Kraken carry air of missed opportunities. And I've seen a couple of articles like this. But they were just talking about like a line out of this story. And it's just talking about what they didn't do, the side deals. And they said, while we don't know what happened behind the scenes, there's evidence that they squandered some appealing opportunities. Just, and that seems to be a consensus. I won't read the whole article, but there are 2 or 3 different ones I've pulled where just, you know, the experts that are writing these are saying, hey, man, they really kind of missed some things, and it doesn't make a ton of sense. What's your take on now that we're kind of sitting back, looking at the free agents they did sign? They signed another goalie, looking at the side deals that weren't made. How do you evaluate what they've done to this point?
Well, and obviously with Grubauer, they're still in the process of reworking the deal because the NHL didn't like the language and how the years were worked out because of the cap ramifications there. So hopefully the Grubauer deal gets signed. Listen, for me, I look at what Driedger did last year in Florida, and I know that there's going to be the conversation about Carey Price, and now obviously it sounds like Carey's going to be able to play for the Habs next year, and that maybe the initial health questions were not as severe as they seemed. That was kind of a unique circumstance where maybe you could have said, hey, they should have drafted Carey Price. But I think this, to take a step back, the Kraken went about this expansion draft and some of their signings in a way that will allow them to have a lot of flexibility. And I think one thing that is different from the standpoint of the Kraken versus the Golden Knights, first of all, you had a lot of GMs that got wise to the ways of the previous expansion draft and were not as easy to deal with, maybe in terms of giving up some of their young players, like what Alex Tuck became, William Karlsson, and Marchessault for Vegas. And I also think that it's just a more cautious approach in general. The cap is going to be flat for a while, we think, in the NHL. And so without that notion, and obviously when the Golden Knights entered, we were not in a pandemic universe where spending was going to be restricted by the cap being fixed and expected growth was happening. And they had more room to maneuver. The Kraken, I think, they don't have the same margin for error, where if you buy up too many big contracts right away, you're a little bit hemmed in. And so do they miss some opportunities? Could they have drafted Tarasenko? Could they have drafted Voracek? He was maybe the one guy from Philly that I would have liked to have seen. But outside of maybe a couple of moves here and there, they did fine. And I think also we got to realize their division, guys, I think it's going to be easy – not easy – it is reasonable for them to compete for a playoff spot in year one, but I think it would be unfair to expect they're going to be able to replicate the success of Vegas, because for one reason, Vegas is in their division, and they're a really good team, and they've been at this for a while. And so I just think they had a better – I would rate their draft better than the critics had it, and I think Matty Beniers was a great pick in the expansion – or in the entry draft. And I would just say to all the Kraken fans – just allow the – it's almost like you're not – if the rebuild is five steps, if a rebuild for the Mariners like is a five-step process, the Kraken are already on like step three. They're not on step five yet. They're on like step three. And that's actually a pretty good place to be as you begin your inaugural season.
He is our MLB expert, our NHL expert, and just like I said, all-around good guy, John Morosi with us. John, we always love the conversation. Thank you so much, and we will be talking again soon.
Can't wait. And by the way, we've got the Huskies coming here to Ann Arbor in a little more than a month, guys.
How about that?
We're going to have to add a fourth sport to our conversations here. We usually mix in some soccer. Now we got college football, a great Big Ten Pac-12 matchup, Michigan-Washington. Can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun.
We're going to have to add another segment. I mean, it's just not enough. There's too much for one segment.
Full hour, guys. Can't wait. Let's make it happen.
Thanks, John.
My pleasure, guys. All the best.
There you go. John Morosi, just a ray of sunshine, really. He's just
I got an important question. You got great questions.
Yeah, so. I won. our thanks to John. Coming up, a man who's been tracking anything and everything here at training camp, Bob Condotta of the Seattle Times, will talk Seahawks with us next. It's Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
We continue live from the VMAC, where everybody has cleared out for the day except for the hardcores, the true football lovers like Dave Wyman, myself, and this man who covers the Seahawks for the Seattle Times is here with us, Bob Condotta. How are you, man?
Good. Yeah. Hey, how are you guys doing?
Condotta was hunched over his computer. I had to go and like jar him from behind like, hey, let's go.
Were you probably nice and comfortable in the air conditioning, right?
Yeah, it's really nice in there for sure.
Yeah. A lot like where you're at now. Yeah. Feels the same. Hey, what's we've isolated a couple players that we said, you know, like Daryl Taylor, we've watched him, said, boy, he really looks good coming off the edge. He's got some explosiveness and speed. Anybody that's caught your eye so far? I know it's only been a brief amount of time, but
yeah. I mean, couple of sort of off the radar guys, I guess. I mean, Jamarius Randall had a real good couple of first days, and he didn't practice today, which sometimes I guess is what happens, right? When you start to catch a guy's eye, then he gets a little injury or something, he's out for a little while. But he had a pick six of Russell in practice a couple days ago. I mean, the star today was a guy probably nobody's really heard of unless you really follow closely, but Ashari Crosswell. Undrafted rookie free agent, free safety from Arizona State, and he had two interceptions today. One was and DJ Reed sort of made the play, but DJ Reed batted a pass away from DK Metcalf that Russell threw a short little pass and batted up in the air and big battle for it. But Crosswell came in and was able to snare it in. And Crosswell's playing a lot because of the safety situation right now and Jamal Adams not being out there, obviously. So yeah. It doesn't take much to get deep into the depth there. They really only have seven safeties on the roster. And then he had a pick off of a Geno Smith, kind of floated a pass over the middle, and he made your classic cutting in front of Colby Parkinson there in midfield to pick it off. So the defense has really been the star, in my opinion, most of the last couple days, most of this week anyway. It just kind of seems like it's been hard for the offense. And today there was, I think, four fumbles and the two picks, and just kind of a sloppy day for the offense. But those are a couple guys that are sort of maybe off of the radar. Yeah. You stand out. Otherwise you do notice a lot of the same guys. But you're right, Daryl Taylor for sure has been a guy that showed up, and he's going to be a really key guy for this team this season.
Crosswell, the only reason I looked him up because I was watching him run going, man, that dude's pretty fast. He kind of stood out, but it's going to be, do you think there's going to be any long shots? We always talk about Doug Baldwin, a free agent rookie that makes this team this year. It seems like it's so competitive, it's going to be tougher than ever.
Well, he's the one who could, simply because I sort of wrote a little thing about him in the spring, because their depth of safety is, there's not a lot of guys there, and especially depending on what they end up doing, how they sort of consider Marquise Blair and Ugo Amadi, who are listed as safeties, but Amadi in particular, I rarely see him play at safety. He's usually just playing nickel. And then Blair, they've had play quite a bit all over the place, but obviously he could be the starting nickel as well. And that's what they could do, is those guys are the nickels, but they always know they can play safety if needed. But depending on how they sort of construct the roster, you could make a case for sure that Crosswell could be a guy who could make it there just because of the way the numbers sort of are in the back end there. Josh Johnson, the running back, had a decent day today. Running backs, to me, are always really hard to judge on these things because they're not tackling them to the ground. So you always see them get hit and bounce off and, continue to kind of run. And so, I think he's done pretty well in blitz pickup and stuff like that. I mean, it seemed like he's caught their eye for a number of reasons. But I don't think a running back's probably going to make this roster the way the running back situation is. And, the defense, they just have so many kind of veteran guys everywhere that I think a lot of the rookies, I think logically, are mostly guys that they're looking at for kind of the practice squad. They're still going to have the 16-man practice squads this year, and the Seahawks basically are going to have 17 because they got to keep Aaron Donker on their practice squad as sort of an extra guy there, and the German kid, yeah,
yep.
And the practice squad situation is the same, where you can call guys up. If you got two times, you can call them up to the active roster on game day. So it's a pretty important thing for them to look at these guys and construct the practice squad that way, knowing that these guys are always going to be available to play on game day.
What do you think we're looking at in the way of timing, excuse me, for the Jamal Adams deal? And then Dwayne Brown, another guy who's walking around here, he's here, but not participating.
Yeah, I mean, my hunch is they want to get Jamal done first and then do Dwayne Brown. Jamal is going to be the bigger, probably a four-year, 70-ish million kind of thing that, I think you got to fit that one in first, and then anything else you would want to do after that. Dwayne, I think you're looking maybe more logically at sort of like a two-year kind of extension, given that he's 36 years old and all of that. So, you're not looking at quite as big of a deal there that's quite as complicated. I personally had sort of thought the Jamal Adams deal would be done right about now. I figured right when they got to pads was sort of when they would want to get it done. I don't think you'd want this to linger too much longer, but he's not a guy who needs to play in preseason games, probably wouldn't really play in preseason games anyway, coming off the injuries he's had and all that. And, obviously we saw late last year, he can get integrated into the defense pretty quickly. So I don't, it's not really a big deal. I mean, obviously since he's here and all of that, it's not like the Earl Thomas or Cam Chancellor situations where they weren't around. So you were sort of worried about it from that standpoint, but, the sooner the better, certainly to get it done with. But, they got tomorrow off, then they got the 3 days with the mock game by Sunday. I wouldn't think you'd want it to linger much past, you know, next week, because once you get into that, you know, play game day kind of thing during the preseason, you know, the days out here to really get a lot done, they get small, you know, they get few and far between quickly, just because you are, you know, you're getting on planes and stuff, where they are once anyway, where you're going through that whole thing where you just don't have as much practice time as you do now.
Do you think that they're going to go a different way, possibly at backup quarterback? Is Mannion enough? I know there's just been some talk about him, and I saw an article I think you wrote about how he's like the second all-time Pac-12 leader in passing, and then to Luke Falk, and then, you know, he's got some – Mannion's got some experience with this offense.
Yeah, I don't really think so. I think Geno Smith has actually looked pretty good. You know, he's had a couple of really good days, and I know I just mentioned the interception he threw, so I don't know if today was his best day, but it was a struggle for the whole offense today, I thought. So
does it look like they have a new offensive coordinator? Do you think the offense is it looking like maybe it's a little disjointed, or is this just defensive players making good plays?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again – when you come out here, and it can be really hard if you come out here, and I know you guys sit on the berm and then watch, you know, a million miles away, they're doing so much situational work. You know, you don't ever see, you know, they're not doing like real football per se, where the offense can get into a rhythm of it's first down at the 20 and you take over and you're moving down the field. You know, it's always suddenly, you know, they're practicing third and longs, or you're practicing, you know, third and goal from the 8. I mean, that was one of their sessions today, was, you know, like 10 straight plays that were all third downs from the 7 or 8 or whatever. And, you know, so those, you're just doing the same thing over and over, and, you know, the defense is, you know, they're not going to lose all of them and all that kind of stuff. So to me, it's really hard to judge that, you know, just because it's not, you know, kind of real football necessarily in those kind of ways.
Everybody's going to blame it on that if, you know, there's an interception. So we're talking about, oh, the defense got them. Well, defenses get interceptions. It doesn't necessarily mean it's because everything is going wrong on the offensive side.
So. Yeah. And you know, the defense does sort of know what they're working on, kind of thing. So, you know, you know, like yesterday, half the day was just a big run drill kind of thing. I never really know how to judge those real well, you know, because they're, you know, they're not tackling guys to the ground and all of that. So you can sort of see, you can see some plays here and there. But you know, I think with the offense, I think it's going to be hard to really judge until they play, you know, the Indianapolis Colts. I don't think we're going to see a lot of it in the preseason. You know, we're all going to be tempted to overanalyze every single thing we see in the preseason and all of that. But, you know, I think the full package isn't something we're going to see until September.
Real quick, we're up against the break, but just give me a thought on Aldon Smith, a guy Dave and I have spent some time talking about and just watching him out here, his power, his explosiveness. He looks just to be a different kind of athlete, but is he a guy? I feel like if he's here, that's gravy, but I'm not counting on his presence here. Where are you at with that?
Well, right now I think he makes the team, and I think he's in the rotation. But I think that's the good thing, is they don't need him to be the starting guy who's going to play, you know, 70% of the snaps or whatever. That's exactly what they can do with him, is kind of find, you know, pick and choose sometimes to fit him in there, and he can play in the rotation as a backup at the rush end spot. But they are, you know, they're really deep on the defensive line for sure. And, you know, I think that's one of the things just watching the defense is you are starting to see, like, I think they're probably going to keep 5 linebackers instead of the 6 or 7 of in the past. And I think that allows them to keep another defensive lineman. You know, if you start looking at it and you know, a guy like Aldon Smith, I think there's a much better way to fit him on and not have to get rid of some other guys that you might've gone in, you know, thinking initially when he was signed, like, who are they going to get rid of to keep Aldon, kind of thing. I think it all seems to make a little bit more sense to me, kind of looking at their personnel that way. So, you know, I think he for sure plays, and he's on the team, and he's a guy that, you know, maybe you only need 15 to 20 snaps a game. I don't think you need as much with Dallas. It sort of appeared from afar, and Aldon sort of alluded to this with his conditioning. You know, he made a comment about his conditioning and everything, that maybe he sort of got wore down with Dallas last year. You know, he got off to a nice start, the 3 sacks in the game against Seattle only in September, only had 2 more the rest of the year. You know, but so if you can find some times when, you know, like, yeah, this is a really good matchup for him, you feature him that week, I think that's more what they can do with him. You know, having Dunlap and Mayoa and, you know, Daryl Taylor, everybody that they're going to have at the rush end spot, you know, they don't need Aldon Smith to be anything more than a complimentary player.
Bob, we appreciate it, man. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah,
Bob.
You guys too. Yeah.
There you go. Bob Condotta from the Seattle
Everything
Times.
Everything you need to know in 10 minutes right there.
He's got it all. He's got it all. We appreciate it. Hey, coming up, are the Mariners destined for a benches-clearing brawl in New York? Man, I hope so. We'll talk about that next. It's Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wyman and Bob.
Live from Seahawks training camp.
On 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
A reminder that our Seahawks training camp coverage is presented by Precor Home Fitness. We continue live from the VMAC. Just a beautiful afternoon out here. They've got the field all fixed up. Now the sprinklers are on, Dave. I didn't see the dogs running around chasing sprinklers.
They were out here earlier, but, yeah, I didn't see them. I hope somebody's giving them water.
That's all that matters, Dave, that they are taken care of. Now, the grounds
crew. Sounds just like my wife.
The grounds crew could be laying face down in a corner. I'd be like, somebody should help them. But where are the dogs? Where are the dogs?
Oh, I know. Yeah, they're so much fun to watch. They're both such good dogs, too.
Oh,
I mean, really disciplined. And my dad used to always say, a well-disciplined dog is a happy dog.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these guys do a really good job with their dogs. But, yeah,
and they're focused because Turf was running behind that cart, ran by me during a break. I was walking to the porta potties over here, and he ran by. I go, Turf. He didn't even look at me.
No.
Didn't even look. Just right behind the cart, jogging, just doing his thing. I was like, wow, okay. What if I had a big piece of beef there or something? He would have just ran by. Nothing.
Maybe.
Totally disciplined. Meanwhile, Mariners will head to New York, begin a four-game series with the hated Bronx Bombers. And we know how things went last time these two teams met. There was a bit of a dust-up because Rugi thought it was suspicious that a ball was thrown inside to him in the ninth inning when it was 4-0, and he thought for some reason they wanted to plunk him so badly they'd start putting runners on base, you know, and then let Aaron Judge come up to the plate to make it a competitive game. That's the baseball logic that was being used by Rugi. And then DJ LeMahieu got his jersey brushed by a pitch, and he really let Kendall Graveman know he was not pleased with it. After the game, cut number 8, this is his explanation, if you will.
Hey, what was going on with Graveman at the end of the game there?
I don't really want to get into it. You know, threw one in on Rugi and the next one in on me. It looks suspicious, but I mean, just baseball.
Was there any prior history between you guys, or is it just simply that at bat with Rugnet and then the inside pitch to you that got you?
Yeah, no history.
Looks suspicious, Dave. Wanted to, put Rugi on, then we're going to plunk you. Then we're going to let Aaron Judge come up there and potentially make it a one-run game in the bottom of the ninth when you're competing with this team for the wild card spot. Makes perfect baseball sense when you talk it through like you did there, LeMahieu. So dumb. I said we were talking about this after it happened initially, and I know people love to hate the Yankees, and I've always been one of those guys, like, I don't hate them, I don't root for them, but I've rooted for individual players on that team I've loved over the years, and I used to love Joe Girardi and Robinson Cano when he was there. They were just players I loved watching, and I enjoy watching them. Now I hate them. Now I've got a lot of sports hate for the Yankees. I thought that was so lame and so pathetic, and they're all out there, chests all puffed up after the game, and, you know, both dugouts staring at each other. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? When you talk about the logic of what you think they were trying to do, it's not like they were up 10-0. It was 4-0.
Yeah.
You brought up the guy at the play that who was going to make it 4-3.
I remember there was an incident down in L.A. where Dave Sims was scolding the crowd because everybody was like, ooh, because they threw like it was an off-speed pitch at Ohtani, and it wasn't even in his kitchen. You know, it was just like, and he's like, come on, people. You know, every once in a while you hear, and these guys are acting like fans. I mean, he sounds like somebody who doesn't know baseball.
Yeah.
His explanation there, but, you know, try being Ty France. I mean, what if Ty France was on their team? They probably would have rushed like 15 mounds because you see today? He had to dive. Didn't die, but he had to, you know, kick his legs back to not get hit again today, Ty France.
He 18. Leads the league now, right?
Well, he's tied with Canna with 18.
Who deserves it, we've determined.
Yeah, so he deserves it. Yeah. But, and he said, pitchers don't like me. But, I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous.
It was so dumb. It was so dumb. And I'm pretty sure there were some Mariner batters that were hit within that series, and there was no retaliation. Now, that's a whole different conversation, saying, you know what, it's time for them to start getting a little uptight with how often they get plunked, and especially Ty France, who doesn't dive into the pitch. He's not diving over the plate. Even though his back foot is toward the line of the box, he's not diving into these pitches. It's just weird how often he gets plunked. But that whole thing was so dumb But at the same time, I kind of appreciate
it's good.
It because it creates
exactly
that rivalry and that hate. And we were trying to determine, all right, is it now the A's or is it now the Yankees? Or now, you know, the Mariners are a good competitive team right now, so that makes it better. They're not a doormat. And you've got a little heat between – so right now I think it's a trifecta of hate. It's the Astros.
Houston.
It's the A's.
Oakland.
And the Yankees have entered.
Yep.
There's a new sheriff in town, and I am looking forward to that. I don't know if anything's going to happen. I would be stunned if there was a brawl. But you know what? If they went up and in on Rugi, got him upset, and did the same to LeMahieu, I'd probably stand in front of my TV just clapping and cheering. Like, there you go. Good.
I'd like him to try to come after Cal Raleigh. Let's see Cal Raleigh tackle Rugi. Cal Raleigh looks like a dude you don't want to mess with.
Yeah.
He's got the big power source and
the big dumper.
Maybe a little cranky.
A little cranky.
Good combination.
Let the big dumper take him down. So, yeah, I'm hoping they buzz the tower of Rugnet. You know, nobody's afraid of him. Stupid. Yeah. All right, that does it for us. Want to thank our guests today, Daryl Taylor, Marquise Blair, John Clayton, and John Clayton's going to join us next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk to John. How about let's do that?
I was thinking about going home,
but let's talk to John.
Well, I was in a thankful mood. We've had a lot of people on today. We just had Bob Condotta on, and we'll see. We'll get into some more Mariner conversation later on as well. But I am so excited about this series. Am I going to be let down? Is there any chance for just a flare up? Could we have just a little stare down?
What you want is three wins and a fight.
Yes.
How about that?
And no injuries to the Mariners.
Yeah.
The Yankees get hurt. Eh, tough. That's how it goes. But we'll see what goes on. That happens tomorrow in game one of a four-game series. Meanwhile, we will turn our attention back to the NFL with the professor, John Clayton, who will join us next as we continue live from the VMAC on 710 ESPN Seattle.